Let's call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Education to order. It's 3 minutes after eight, and it is February 6th. Present today, Representative Jewel Stevens.
Thank you.
Guests, Wilson, Porter, and myself, Bundy. We do have a quorum. On today's calendar, we'll continue our discussions from last week of various subcommittee reports, and we will address HB 211. Of course, if you have cell phones in the audience, turn those off. If you'd like to testify, please do sign up. On teleconference today, we have Kenai, Kodiak, Kotzebue, Wrangell, Anchorage, and Mat-Su. We are streaming on the web again, and so the little red buttons in back, I'll keep track of that for you, but we have both Gavel and that coverage, and we thank the staff that are providing that. Anybody that wishes to testify, if you give us your name, your title, your affiliation, we'd appreciate that, and would like to keep testimony as concise as possible. That applies to everyone except committee members, of course, because we know that's not possible, particularly with the chair. And with that, let us move to our first item of business, and that's a service learning report, Representative Wilson. And I would ask Superintendent Wilson if you would join us, please. And if you'd like to begin, Representative Wilson.
Okay. Our school system does the service learning in our area. The seniors do it, and anybody that goes out for sports or anything like that or extracurricular activities does it. So I would like to just turn it over to Mr. Wilson and let him do it. And we do have the president of the senior class, Katie Roop, and she has already done hers for this year, and she can share what she has done.
Just thank you. Just before you begin, Superintendent, just to preface for the audience, I think the committee is aware from our previous discussion that at least I have some concerns, and probably shared by many, that in some cases, our young people don't have as much attachment to our society as we'd like. And in some areas of the country, the service learning requirement has helped establish that attachment a little more clearly. And so this is something that I'd hope that we consider, bring out at least for discussion and shine a little brighter light on what some people are already doing. So, Superintendent, if you could briefly outline your program, requirements for service learning, and then we'd be interested in hearing from, is it Katie?
Katie.
Yeah, thank you.
Very good. For the record, I am Woody Wilson, Superintendent of Wrangell Public Schools. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about service learning. It is something that we do in Wrangell, have done for a number of years now, and exactly for the reason that you mentioned, Representative Bundy, it draws a connection from the students to the community and the community to the school. We believe that's a very important connection because it is the community in many ways that support our students. That's why we have service learning in Wrangell, or one of the main reasons is to make sure that the community recognizes the work they do for the students in bringing them up and helping raise those children. Also, the students recognize what the community has given to them, and they have an opportunity to give back. In the material that I gave you, I gave what I would call an executive summary. It talks about three kinds of service learning that we do in Wrangell. One is what we call senior projects. Senior projects are required for graduation. Every student must complete a senior project that gives something back in terms of service or worth to the community. At the end of their senior project, we try to incorporate, or what we call in education terms, integrate the different standards that the state has given us. And a part of that is learning how to present in front of people, learning how to speak in front of people and give presentations. So a second part of the service learning project is the presentation that each senior must give. It has to be an electronic presentation. So it's either in PowerPoint or electronic video or some means of technology that's used to present their senior project for a group of people. And that's, we think, also another important part of our education, that students should be able to do those kinds of things before they graduate from high school. We also have two other kinds of service learning, the second being the activities service learning that students do. Because of budget crunches in the past years, we don't pay for state travel for students any longer in Wrangell with school money. So all state travel, whether it's basketball or vocational education, if students have to go to compete in Anchorage, that is paid for through fundraising and money that comes from the community. So that again is an additional burden on the community, and so students are asked to pay back 16 hours of community service for every activity that they might be involved in. So if a student's in basketball, drama debate, music, they would have to contribute 48 hours of community service. If they're a senior, they have to do that in addition to their senior project. So it's a lot of work for kids. And we brought a student with us today. Katie is actually the president of the student body, and she can perhaps answer any questions you might have about the types of service learning that students do, and how that fits in. The one thing that I'm glad you're interested in this, we think it's a great way for students to learn volunteerism, to learn their place in the community and how important it is for them to give back. But it's not without a cost. In a school district our size, we have about 150 students in the high school, and it takes between 1/8 of a teacher and a little more than a quarter, depending upon how many seniors you have and how many students you have involved in these activities, to supervise and make sure that everything works as it's supposed to. Nothing comes without a cost. So that may or may not work in every school district in the state, but it works for us.
Well, you addressed my initial question, which was cost. And an eighth of a teacher in Wrangell would translate to how many dollars?
Well, let's see. Would be probably with benefits $8,000 to $12,000.
$8,000 to $12,000, and that's 150 students, so people could, you know, realizing accounting a scale, but could get some idea in larger schools or smaller schools what might be involved.
If you have two teachers, then it becomes a quarter, and so. And then there are other things. We actually have people that help with the activities. Booster clubs are, it's quite a little organizational piece to put together when you have every student that's involved in any kind of an activity contributing 16 hours. And then if they're in, some of the students would be in as many as four, is that correct? Three, anyway.
Possibly three.
Three activities. So there's some record keeping and, of course, a lot of things that go along with that somebody has to take care of.
Questions for the superintendent? If not, I'd like to ask, is it Roop or Rope?
Roop.
Ms. Roop to give us her view of the service learning in Wrangell.
Mr. Chair and Chair members, basically I'm going to tell you about my senior project, what I did. For the first semester of school, I worked after school a couple times a week with the swim team coach, so I helped him to coach some of the younger kids. This was his first year being a swim team coach, and I've swam in the past, so I think it's important to remember that students often use some of their past experiences and knowledge to later benefit the community. People taught me to swim, and I grew up and I have a senior project, and I help to teach other people to swim. So that was the first part, and I haven't done my presentation yet, but I'm going to do an iMovie about having with video showing what I did helping to teach these kids to swim.
In a city the size of Wrangell, do students sometimes find it challenging to find projects?
I think sometimes they're kind of up in the air about what they want to do, but I don't think anyone's ever had a problem finding things to do. There are a huge range of people, of activities that students choose to do. From a lot of times they teach a class about something they know. We've had a photography class taught, or they also a sign language class taught. Sometimes they would assist preschool and elementary teachers work with kids if that's their interest, or organizing different programs. Like someone organized the Southeast Art Festival. People put on plays, they put on musicals. Or sometimes they organize Pee Wee Wrestling, that's usually a senior project. Last year, a student organized the Wrangell Youth Court, which is still continuing now. So I really don't think that I've known of anyone who had a real hard time finding something.
So far, I've heard a lot of more cerebral activities, I guess. Do young people also do things like clean up the park, or I hope you don't have a lot of vandalism, but respond to that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Actually, sometimes what kids will do, they will train for emergency trauma training or become junior firefighters. So they'll get their training through their senior project, and then after they graduate, they're trained and ready to do that. Kids have done also recycling projects. That was something that people did.
We had a question from Representative Stevens.
Okay, it's just a real pleasure to hear from a real student. We usually hear from superintendents and officials and that sort of thing, so it's nice to hear what you're actually doing. And you'll have no problem making that presentation the way you've done today. Could you just, I know it's a little hard to do, but you give us some idea of the value you received from this experience? Can you identify any values that you received from doing this?
I think at first students are going to be a little weary. They might not want to do it, and they might complain a little bit. But basically, you realize that you can, becoming involved in an activity, one way it really helps the student is that it helps identify what they like to do, what they might want to do once they get out of high school. If you work with kids, you might realize either that you really love it or that you really hate it. So that's one thing that's a value that you learn. You also, you're going to feel good about what you're doing, even if some people may say that, well, you're forced to do this, so it's not really a volunteer activity, but you can always choose, not to graduate or not to be involved in other activities. So,
we have those with the high school competency test that are choosing not to graduate.
So there's many values that you'll get out of these projects that.
I'm sure you said it in jest, choosing not to graduate, but are there students who really feel put upon or rebellious or frustrated or angry about this requirement?
We might complain a little bit, but I really don't think there's anyone who would absolutely not do it.
Wouldn't be a teenager if you didn't complain a little bit. Okay, thank you. Other questions? Yes, Representative Jewell.
Not a question, but a comment. Because I think this whole concept of community service is interesting when you look at the especially in outlying areas of our communities, the transition that people have had to make in terms of what their role in a family is. And as we bring in water and sewer and electricity, and we've brought all of these changes, the normal things that families would have had to do, where those contributions to the home were extremely important and gave that individual a sense of where their place is, no longer exists. And so the culprit of a lot of our woes, especially I think amongst some of our younger people, is this idle time that has been created and the void that exists. And so if there is a meaningful role maybe that cannot be fulfilled in the home because of certain kinds of things, but can be addressed in the community, you add value to that individual in a very important way. And I think, and I really would like to commend the school district for doing that, because when you can validate somebody's reason for doing something, you're upping what they think of themselves in that place. So I really commend you for what you're doing, and I think that I'd really like to see more school districts do this, because that culprit, idle time, is kind of a hidden thing, and we don't identify it. We identify all the things around it. But the issue oftentimes is that idle time.
I'm not qualified to make religious pronouncements, but I think I've heard in the past idle hands are the tools of the devil. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to make a comment. Our community as a whole really looks forward to the presentations, because when they do the presentations, a big part of the community is invited, so that they're not just doing it in front of their peers, they're doing it in front of their parents and other people in the community. So it's a kind of a sounding board for them, too, to be able to be important and at the same time contribute. And so it's been very well received in our community, and the people look forward to the people of the community look forward to the students performing different activities for the community, whether it be raking somebody's yard. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things involved here, and so it's been very good for our community.
And that is a key that maybe we need to discuss more as a committee, as a, you know, how's that a vital ingredient of community support for this program? It would be easy to pass along and say everyone shall do this, but I could see a lot of foot dragging if there wasn't community support. Well, I thank you very much, Ms. Roop. We appreciate your participation, and congratulations on your leadership at your school, and we'll wish you well in your future endeavors. Thank you, Superintendent.
Thank you.
I did want to see if Larry Wiggett was on teleconference in Anchorage. Hello, Anchorage. Oh.
A little alarm. Larry Wiggett is here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Wait a minute.
Do you still have your feet on the ground?
That's shaking pretty hard. Real
we're
hard.
Really shaking here.
Well, I think we won't ask you to testify at the moment, but when it's over, would you get back to us and tell us that you're okay?
Yeah, we will. So far, still shaking.
It's freaky.
Well, we're going to pass a law against that, too. Well, I will close public testimony on this issue, and it's premature to ask the committee for any response or direction, but I think that I would like in a week or so to get feedback to see if there's some role we could play to encourage the service learning, and of course, then what would the cost be to that? And I will send out a memo to some representative school districts and ask if what they have and if they would like be interested in expansion, and of course, what they think the state's role should be, represent students.
Mr. Chairman, it appears, and if I heard this right, that the Wrangell has done this as a way to offset the tremendous costs of student travel. And though I see there's a cost involved in hiring teachers, there's also a tremendous savings to the districts. And as districts look at what is essential to an education, I think you'll see many districts thinking seriously about the cost of travel. It makes some economic sense as well.
It'd be interesting to see some of our hockey players making video PowerPoint presentations. All right, thank you. And I'm sure they're very capable.
Very big sticks you need to be careful.
Yeah, there's all kinds of terrible puns going through my mind, but I want to move on to Representative Guess's presentation about health and liability insurance and what the state role might be in trying to help districts address those increasing costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My apologies. I was not told I was on the agenda. We are still gathering information about both health care liability and building liability.
There's a concise report, and we thank you.
As soon as we get it going and complete, I'll...
For public information, CERT and Kenai are also having an earthquake. It sounds like it's pretty substantial. We'll certainly hope to hear more reports. Anchorage, are you on?
We're still here.
Yeah, okay, that's really good news. Just a brief report for us on the earthquake. Is there damage?
Not that we can tell. We're fine here, sir.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. I don't know if you heard my comments, Larry. I'll be sending you folks a memo asking about the interest in the Anchorage District as far as participating in service learning and what you do and what you might want to do and what the state could do to facilitate. We now will move on to the Regional Training Center report from Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think each of you were given a copy of what we were able to dig up. And first thing I'd like to do is thank Gwen Cornelius, who talked to a lot of the districts and to see what they were doing on this issue. There's kind of the current situations. We have few teachers, little opportunity to feel part of the workforce, and limited frame of reference for students. And so the whole concept, Mr. Chairman, is to use the hub communities as a way to bring students in from smaller communities, not only to gain an opportunity to address academic issues that they may not be able to address in their smaller schools, but the opportunity to learn about the career job opportunities that are often in the nucleus hubs of the regions that they live in. And some of the opportunities here, obviously, is exposure to different environments, potential to learn additional college level credits or work through the vocational programs, and to be part of the workforce. And one of the concepts in all of this is to use, for instance, a grade 14. And we talked about this. You often refer to this as kind of going back to the community college concept, but students being able to stay in a program such as this and move on beyond high school, make a more of a seamless transition into post-secondary education. And for those, it provides those who may not have passed the high school qualifying exam by the 12th grade additional opportunities to move forward and still work towards certification through voc-ed program or earning college credits. Just to touch briefly on the boarding school, well, I'll save the boarding school issue for last. What some of the districts are doing now, in the report, Gwen talked to the Chugach Regional School District where they have the Anchorage House, and the Chugach School District has really been, I think, kind of a model for smaller schools. They're really doing some exciting things. They've got some national awards in areas that school districts just don't get recognized for doing some out-of-the-box things, and I think that is extremely wonderful.
Interrupt just for a moment to ask if you could expand or try to help you expand on the Anchorage House for the other committee members.
The Anchorage House, thank you. I forget my audience. The Anchorage House, what the Chugach School District has done is they have a 2 to 6 bedroom houses in Anchorage where when students come in from the smaller districts into Anchorage, they become responsible for their own living. They're put on a budget. They have to go do their own shopping. They have to take care of all of these little things in addition to the educational opportunities that they're able to gain while they're there. And they start them as early as the 5th grade. And for some, at that age, they bring them in for about 3 days at a time. But for the older students, the high school students, are actually doing OJT mentoring and that sort of thing, where they are learning about the opportunities in the workforce. So that's
sorry to interrupt, but I might add, it's a school requirement that for varying periods of time, but particularly for the older students, they come and live in Anchorage for up to a month, have to get involved in job shadowing or some other hands-on experiences with jobs. And plus, they have to, as I say, be responsible for their room and board. They have to they divide up tasks in the house and that sort of thing. And obviously, there's a cost to that, but it does give the young people a chance to see other vocational opportunities.
Absolutely. And one of the things that they're now starting to do is to bring parents in so that parents could be more supportive of their children as they go through this process. That's pretty exciting. And this, I don't know how long this has occurred, but apparently it's now open to other students from other districts as well.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Right. The Lower Kuskokwim, the Bethel area, and that's Chugach. And I can't Lower Kuskokwim area has the BABS program, and they started this back in 1997 to meet some of the needs of the students at risk. And I was out visiting that school probably 2 years ago, and we visited with the students, with the instructors, and the neat thing about that, and they were bringing in students from the smaller communities as well, because it was a boarding home. But one of the things that was pretty neat was when we went out into the community that afternoon, some of those students were working and doing. So we were seeing the students not only in the classroom setting, but we were seeing them on the job as well, and that's expanded up to 35 students. And they have a new program that hasn't got started yet. Thank you. And this will be for grades 9 through 14. It'll be open to the region, not
this. This is the Bethel area.
This is the Bethel area still. They're looking to have a 200 to 250 student capacity. And they're working this through a grant from USDA and Department of Interior. And there's a proposal in the governor's budget as well for this concept. And it's a consortium of 19 organizations to provide vocational ed in areas needed in the reading, including health trades, or the health, construction trades, technology, and education fields. And this will run year-round, not just the normal school year. Another school that was contacted was Galena. They have project education. This is more of a boarding school, but they have 72 students from all over the state. This has been running for about 5 years. And it appears they have about a 97% return rate in their students. They focus on post-secondary education and careers. But they've kind of gone outside of the state funding source and have partnered up with industry. And some of the folks that they've partnered up with, the U.S. Air Force, Suzuki, General Motors, Compact, Frontier Flying. So they offer kind of a wide variety of stuff out there. And it sounds like they have some pretty strict policies in maintaining their attendance and maintaining a certain level of GPA. The other thing that they do is if they don't pass a portion of their high school qualifying exit exams, they go through this process, they're required an hour of tutoring every day after school to kind of address those issues as well. Last year we saw a bill in the House that Representative Foster had kind of addressing this area for Nome and Bering Straits area. And I think they still need to get some things worked out in that area, but this is exactly the kind of thing that they were looking at. The Northwest Arctic Borough School District is also taking a real hard look at this at the grade 14, up to grade 14 level. And, you know, one of the questions or concerns is as the students come in, well, we don't have there is no dorm facility for the high school students, that they would place students in the community. And one of the challenges there has to do with being able to obtain some sort of a stipend for those students while they're in doing this. And then finally, and in Kotzebue, they would utilize both the Votech Center as well as the UAF branch campus, Chukchi, to obtain credits and work towards certification. Kind of one of the other things that I thought was kind of neat out in the Aleutians Borough, East Borough, is they have live interactive video TV where they've taken and placed cameras and monitors in some of their outlying communities, and students can sit in a class and the teacher be in another community and they're live, and they have the E-rate, yeah, which saves them substantial amounts of money. I think it cost them about $40,000 to do this now with the E-rate. Without the E-rate, it's like, what did you say?
$400,000. They have 90% of students on school lunch programs.
Oh, so this is, you know, another concept that's where you're utilizing the ability of teachers who have an expertise in an area being able to deliver back to smaller communities. And so this is pretty neat. And those are some of the things we looked at, Mr. Chairman. As I mentioned the last time, a couple of years ago, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee talked to many of the school districts, Fairbanks, Nome, Kotzebue, Bethel, St. Mary's, Soldovia, Kodiak, I think, Seward, about the concept of should we have other boarding schools besides Mount Edgecombe. And I think there is some interest, and you know, I'm not sure of the forum of the kind of LBNA committee has kind of put that on the back burner, and I'm not sure if they want to readdress that issue. But I think there is still some interest by some of the districts, but from some of the conversations that we've had with districts, that this regional learning center might be something that's more attractive. You have students who are not threatened about having to leave home, or parents and communities having their students leave home, but still can experience for varied lengths of time not only issues of classroom experience in the regional hub center and the networking that would occur in a setting like that, but I think more importantly is the opportunities that exist in terms of employment, specifically in some of the hub centers. Oftentimes, when we think of education, we also think of putting people to work. And from the village, there's not a lot of opportunities for work other than teaching, a little bit of healthcare, aviation, working in the post office, the Native Corporation, the tribe, or the city. And but yet, I think if we were to expand the thinking of how jobs could be addressed, I think people would be very interested in the concept of job sharing, where you could come in to a hub community, work, and basically job share, so that you could live at home in your time off, but come in and be able to bring that income back to your community. And it's worked well for the oil patch. It's worked well for places like Red Dog. And I think if we look at the nucleus of our economies and the regional hub centers, there may be some innovative things that we can do in terms of stimulating the economies back in those communities by having people come in to work. And but that's what we've been able to dig up so far. There's other information we just limited to this.
Well, thank you, Representative Jewell. I think you addressed or began to address a couple of the questions that jump up right away, those of us that lived through Molly Hooch, whether there would be some concerns in rural areas that this is attempting to go back to pre-Molly Hooch, and what would be, what's the public reaction there? And the other that you, I think, addressed was how to, if we encourage people to move out of a small village for employment, Are they apt to come back, or will there be a brain drain in the small village because the young people are leaving? And issues that are more psychological than fiscal, I guess.
Those are very important issues in our communities. And I think people would feel less threatened about the concept of education. If you take healthcare, because it's so rare, it's kind of like low-hanging fruit. I think of the physicians that we have at home. I think we have 8 in Kotzebue at the regional hospital. And at this point, there's no local doctors. You know, the salaries that they drag down there, I would, just ballparking, would be about around 100 grand a year, if not more. Now, if 2 students from different villages were to pursue a degree to practice medicine, or a certificate to practice medicine, in these regional centers where they are run by their nonprofits or their native health boards, I think the health boards would be tickled pink to be able to hire people from their area and allow them to come in on a rotating schedule and job share, because you can do a lot with half of that $100,000 salary back in your village and live in your village. And when you come to the regional hub center in the center, in the case of at least the medical field, generally there is subsidized housing. And so the cost of living in those communities, I mean, there's other questions, certainly, Mr. Chairman, and that is people leaving their families and other things. But I think we need to look in this direction just to start stimulating and let people know what their opportunities are.
Questions for Representative Jewell? Representative Stevens.
Well, just an observation, Mr. Chairman. I first arrived in Kodiak in 1970 when they were just in the process of dismantling the regional boarding school there, and a lot of people were unhappy with all sorts of things, with the moving children out of families, moving them into a larger community, access to things that they had not been used to before, kids getting in trouble, homesick and all that. And it's certainly well worth looking at. I think we need to, but we also need to, learn from the past and figure out why did it not work last time. I think you're right, and it gives kids a lot of advantages, but maybe some disadvantages too. But when you look at a lot of the Native leadership in our state now, many of those people seem to have come through Edgecombe, so certainly that has opened up worlds of opportunities for many people. But we want to be very cautious about this and trying to figure out what went wrong last time we did this.
You know, one of the things I think that really is an opportunity for the state here is that I don't think it's the intent of this committee to just carte blanche say that this is going to happen. I think for those districts that have a plan of how they want to deliver this and show an interest in it, that we make every attempt to work with that district so that we do have some projects for those that are ready to make this kind of a transition. And I think that would be one difference. And in this regional learning center concept, it is different, I think, much different concept than a boarding school concept, because there you're taking them for the entire year. But I think one of the other major pluses, I used healthcare. But part of the nucleuses of those regional economies are the native corporations, whether it's the association, the nonprofits, or the regional corporations, or the village corporations. And getting people to see their opportunities there at the hub communities. Aviation. And a whole host, the parks, or the federal government you know, in many parts of the state for major employers. And we're continuing to import a lot of our workforce. And this allows us the opportunity of continuing on a continuing basis to show our students what their opportunities are right there. And I think we'd be remiss not to afford some of those districts that are willing to take this kind of a step to do that. Because I think that whether it's, we have to find a way to grow our own, and we won't if people do not understand that those opportunities exist and experience.
You know, I think that's was what I was looking for here. Give the committee and hopefully the interested public an idea of what's going on and what could potentially happen. I agree there's not a lot that this committee or the state should try to impose, but if there's interest that comes from the bottom up and looking for some help from the state or this committee to facilitate that, maybe then we've done our job here this morning. So with that, Representative Wilson.
I just had a, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a comment upon that because I think it's really important. I think some of the programs that kind of will evolve from the different school districts will be partly from the need that's in that school district, and the need in each local area is different. We're in Wrangell, where we've kind of evolved this service learning program was from not having enough funds for sports and things like that. You have to kind of make your cuts and decide what's the most important, and the people of the community decided that was important, so where the children start going out and actually fundraising on their own, we realized that there had to be a structure there so that and a little bit of a control. The same in the area here. I think that they're realizing that there's students there that they've all got potential, but they don't necessarily want to go out into the world and go to Anchorage or to the Lower 48. They want to stay close to family and home, and so they're realizing that there's a need there to educate the students, and what will work in the Kotzebue area wouldn't work in Wrangell. And I think that they have looked at the old boarding school concept, realizing the negative aspects of that, and are shaping something so that there's a transition period, and 3 days for a fifth grade student maybe, and go back home. That's not as traumatic when they know that in 3 days they're going back home, but it's a transition type period. And so I think that an aspect of this is we really need to realize that no mandates from us, maybe encouragement, but allowing, if we as legislators can allow certain things to happen. Sometimes we have to make some changes to make sure that they can do these things. But I think the local control and the local needs are addressed, and they kind of evolves kind of.
Last thing we want to be is the big brother of education. For the committee and the audience's information, ace reporter over here. The earthquake was a 4.8. It was 10 miles southeast of Anchorage and 17 miles deep. So probably accounts for some of the feelings at the LIO if it was out close to home. I'd like to move on now to Representative Guest as a courtesy to our committee member. I'm going to bring up HB 211 at the sponsor's request. We'll turn it over to Representative Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you taking up HB 211 again. In your packets, you have amendment number one. You move that amendment. All this does is update from the work we did last year and make it a current bill.
Any objection to amendment number one?
No.
Mr. Wilson? All right. We have adopted amendment number one then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My intent today, if it is okay with the committee, is to actually move 211. It is my strong belief that it is good education policy to inflation-proof the foundation formula. We adjust every year for the number of kids. We do not ask school districts to come back if they have more students every year. Rather, we assume they will need more funding if they have more students. In the same vein, I believe if the cost of living goes up, we should automatically adjust foundation funds for that. What I would like to do is move this out of the committee today so we can have the debate in this body of whether or not it's good fiscal policy. I believe it's good educational policy. I actually believe it is good fiscal policy, but that is a debate for the finance committee. So at this time, I will entertain any questions. We had testimony on this last year, so I don't plan to have any more testimony, but I'm available for questions.
Questions for Representative Guest. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A comment, probably more than a question, is the fact that I really like this bill. In our school system, over the last, I think it's 11 years, we've actually not increased the school funding per per pupil, and in fact, we have gone backwards. And the inflation in that period of time was 35%. So it's really made it difficult on our school system to be able to, we've really had to try to think out of the box to come up with ways to be creative and still have a good school system. So I really like this bill, and at the proper time, would like to move that we pass it out of committee.
The inflation was 35%. I don't think I understand that. It certainly wasn't at national level.
That's over just counting the state average over those years and adding it up.
And that assumes, of course, that the funding level that you're building inflation from was the proper one. And some would say that was in the 80s we were spending money like drunken sailors, but I understand your point. Other comments? Is there anybody, I'm sorry, we weren't going to ask for, what I'm doing is stalling. I had a question, I can't remember what it was. Brain freeze.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, thank you, Representative Jewell. Get me off this embarrassing spot.
Would you like a motion?
Is there further discussion or further questions? I understand where it is you would like to go. I personally have some problems with, I think investment in education. If you're going to spend any money in the legislature this year, I think we should spend it in education. However, we spent the money that Monday that I would have spent on education, so I have some problems there with additional spending at this point. But Representative Jewell.
Mr. Chairman, I would move HB 211 out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Oh, I will.
As amended.
As amended. I will object so we can have a vote. Karen, would you call for the vote, please? Somebody. Okay, never mind. I have so much help.
Representative Green, Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Stevens?
Yes.
Representative Jewell?
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Porter?
Yes.
Chairman Bundy?
No. So we have moved 211 from committee to this next committee referral, which will be finance, and that will,
of course.
Oh, it is going to Hess. I'm sorry. Thank you for that correction.
And then we'll see you in finance.
And then we will have the financial discussion in finance. Okay, we have another issue to address, and we're doing really well on the time limit this. I want credit for the this week for what we did last week and went over. But I'd now like to bring before the committee a discussion of the possibility of doing a committee bill to rehire RIPT or retired and or retired teachers. And we do have some folks that would like to testify on this. So let's go to the teleconference first, and then Matt Sue, LIO, there's someone who would like to testify on the a possibility of retiring teachers who have previously ripped?
Hello, thank you very much. My name is Carol Payne, and I am the Executive Director for the Alaska Association of Secondary School Principals. And I just want to say thank you for hearing our comments on this issue. We would definitely like to have you reconsider including the RIP teachers that were excluded last year from HB 242. And I think it's also important to include administrators in that language. The reason that we believe that this is important is because, as you've heard us testify before, there is a critical shortage for not only teachers, but school administrators and other school personnel that we're facing now, and it will even become more critical in the next few years. With this ability to include the RIP teachers in your employment pool, it'll meet the critical shortage area in not only special education and counseling, but again, in the pool of administrators, which there are much fewer that we're seeing every year. It would also give the opportunity to try to entice more individuals to come into the profession and how to better able meet those needs. It's going to give the districts at an individual site and district-wide the opportunity to hire back experienced teachers and administrators into the field and act as mentors to those teachers and administrators coming in. And you will also save the district's money in salary and retirement expenses because those are already being dealt with. We know that the salaries across the United States, Alaska is no longer at the competitive level that we used to know. We know that in other states, teachers and administrators are given signing bonuses, living expenses, loan advantages, and so they truly are taking away some of our best retired individuals that would be very beneficial to the state of Alaska. And as you heard in the earlier testimony, our theory of growing our own, we believe that we do have exemplary administrators and teachers in the state, and we would certainly like to have you encourage us to retain that possibility. On April 1st and 2nd, principals will be coming down and hopefully meeting with each of you. And we want you to know that we are available to assist you in any way possible. And we appreciate all your efforts to address this. And I am available for questions if you need me to answer anything.
Thank you. And do have a question. And I know this is speculative, but off the top of your head, if this had been law this year, how many teachers or retired or RIP teachers might have Matt Sue rehired?
And you're right. I don't have that statistics. I did talk with Paul Harrison, who is the Human Resources Director. And the only thing I can say to you is that it would have helped them a great deal. They had a very difficult time in hiring the special ed teachers and counselors specifically, but I cannot give you a number.
Okay, thank you. And how many teachers are you currently looking for? What's your shortage at this moment?
Again, I don't have those specific numbers. Paula had another meeting that she had to attend, and so I can't provide you that number today, but I can certainly find that out for you.
Would probably be useful if you could, and then we could add it to the committee record of this bill if we indeed create a bill and it goes forward, because I'm sure those are questions people will ask. I know I have, for the committee's information, noted, and I think you've seen the number of retired teachers that districts have rehired, in most cases just one or two. I think we had comments previously that this wouldn't solve the entire problem, but it's an additional tool that people would look to assist them. I would like then to come back to Juno here for testimony and comments. And Mark Jones. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Mark Jones. I'm with the National Education Association, and I appreciate the indulgence of the committee because I am in part going to touch on some issues that you were talking about last week, in addition to some of the issues that you're dealing with this week, specifically the teacher retention issue and then last week's mentoring issue. Just to put it into context, There are several problems that I think are facing this state, and not just this state, but all states in the realm of education. And that is, how do we enhance the quality of instruction? How do we attract and retain the best and the brightest? How do we improve constantly or continually the quality of instruction within the classroom? I believe that mentoring is a tool that will address most of those issues. In order to appreciate why I believe mentoring is a tool that this committee ought to get out and support in, with the full force of the state legislation, you need to look at the whole profession of teaching historically. Historically, teaching is a very lonely and isolated profession. It's one of the few professions that I know of where a person comes out of school, is placed into a confined classroom with four walls and a door, and is expected to take off and produce high-quality outcomes from the get-go. Very few opportunities are built into the school setting for teachers to interact with each other, to share ideas, to nurture each other, to learn together. So in the bigger picture, mentoring is part of the creation, I believe, of a learning environment within a school. It is the creation of a collegial environment with professional teachers providing tutoring, mentoring, and educational or instructional leadership to their colleagues. In that context, let me say that for a number of years now, I have been helping establish mentor programs throughout the state of Alaska, because we've been very concerned about the number of new teachers coming into the state, the high level of turnaround that occurs or turnover that occurs when those teachers arrive in communities unprepared or ill-prepared for the task at hand. So we have, through our associations, been establishing mentor programs. Ketchikan is a good example of a program that has been established and functional for about 4 or 5 years now. We've learned some lessons in the context of setting up that mentor program that I think the state might benefit from. First of all, mentoring is not a casual relationship. It is not a buddy system. It is important and critical that the people who are selected to mentor are selected on the basis of well-defined criteria, that they receive a curriculum of study that helps them understand adult learning processes. In addition to that, they need an opportunity during the course of the workday, both the mentor and the protege, to interact with each other, to observe, to do demonstration teaching, to exchange ideas about what is occurring in the classroom and problems and concerns. So we need training, we need a good selection process, we need time for observation and debriefing. In addition, I have learned through the private sector mentoring studies that have been conducted that confidentiality in the relationship, a trust relationship, is critical. We have several examples of ad hoc mentor programs throughout the state of Alaska where administration is asking the mentor to provide input to the evaluator, and what has happened as a result of that is that the trust between the protege and the mentor has deteriorated, so that's an ineffective relationship. In looking at the research that's been done in the private sector, a fellow by the name of Marshall Goldsmith, who's a well-known mentor trainer, has discovered that in doing comparison, side-by-side comparison studies, that the progress and growth rate of individuals who are in mentor relationships that are confidential and trusting in nature are 35% better than in relationships where the mentor is part of the evaluation process. So I think it's a very important lesson that we can learn in the state of Alaska for educators. I think that another thing that is critical, and I think we've already had some conversations with Representative Jewell about our interest in creating mentor programs that involve Alaska Native paraprofessionals in pairs with new people, new teachers to the community. We believe that teachers coming from outside the state into an Alaska Native village have no concept of what they're dealing with. Often, by the time they have discovered what the cultural distinctions are, they have made mistakes that have alienated them from the community. They have become dissatisfied because they don't know how to interact with people effectively, and as a result, many of them leave. We believe that if we could effectively train and prepare Alaska Native paraprofessionals to serve as mentors, that we would deal with the cultural conflicts that occur when new teachers arrive in the state. In addition, we would like to do some organizing with communities to bring communities into the mentoring process so that they're part of the nurturing of these new teachers in the community. I appreciate the time that you've taken. I know that this kind of took the issue back a week, but I do believe that it touches on retention issues, teacher or educational quality issues, and the induction program issues that are all facing this committee this year.
Thank you. You did mention, I think in writing here, you could submit written testimony, and poor long-suffering secretary would appreciate that.
I will be more than happy to do that.
Okay. And before you leave,
sure.
On the issue, to the issue at hand, has NEA Alaska taken a position on being able to rehire teachers who have taken the RIP? There is some competition between, you know, the old guard and the new guard
right,
when we look at this.
Well, last week I did mention the concern that we have about the use of the retirement system as a supplementary compensation program for teachers. That being said, I think we're very sensitive to the notion, or to the concerns that are facing schools right now. There are some critical shortages occurring in some key areas: special education, speech, occupational therapists, school psychologists, some higher level math and sciences. In that context, I think for a short-term solution, bringing back retirees is a critical tool in the toolbox. I think I've heard that cliche mentioned a number of times. I do think at the same time we need to focus on developing long-term solutions to our problem.
Representative Porter had a question.
If you would, you used a statistic on one type of mentoring program versus another, that if the mentor is not involved in the evaluation process of the mentee,
the protege,
that the program is 35% better. Could you put some meat on it better?
I actually, in a written supplement, can provide you with the sources for that information and the studies that occurred. But in general, Marshall Goldsmith studies success rates based on criteria that are defined by the employer, the employee, and the mentor in setting up these individual mentor relationships. So if, let's say that a mentor comes into a school setting and the mentee or the protege defines school classroom management as one of their primary concerns, and then they define what classroom management issues they have problems with, they would systematically work at remedying each of those defined categories. In issues where the protege knows that what they say to the mentor is confidential, they will be more forthcoming about what they feel when they're going through this process, what they perceive as their own weaknesses. At the end of the process, according to these studies, there is a 35% better success rate in meeting those defined goals, whatever they are, than in relationships where the mentor then becomes part of the evaluation process. I don't know if that helps you understand how they came up with that statistic. What is defined as success or growth in any one program is individualized because of the nature of mentoring. But after it's been defined, are the people successful in getting to their goal? And I don't know whether they took a cumulative growth rate and said that 35% more people in the confidential relationships met their goal. I will get that information for you and include it in my written comments.
If there's identification of this, who set the goal?
Well, the goals in most of the studies were set between the mentor, the mentee, or the protege, and the employer or the evaluator. The supervisor in private sector mentoring, the mentor relationship is generally set up because there are performance expectations that aren't being met. So there are clear issues that need to be addressed. In education, on the other hand, we're recommending mentoring as a general course in the induction process, that every educator ought to go through it, because there is so much to learn from the more seasoned teachers.
And thank you. It does say, I do need to move on. It does say something about how good principals will be as mentors then, because they are definitely evaluating. But thank you. We do have Carol Kane here who wanted to testify. Oh, I'm sorry, she's online. Ms. Kane? All right, well, we'll move on. Comments from the committee. We'll close public testimony, and what the chair would like is some direction as to whether we should author a bill that would basically repeal the prohibition of RIP teachers being rehired. Last week we did have the discussion that from the retirement folks that there is no negative actuarial impact with such a bill. There may be some political or concerns, but there's no actuarial concerns. And I'm looking for direction from the committee. Representative Stevens.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we've studied this pretty carefully and heard that it could be a real advantage to superintendents and districts to have this as an option. We're not forcing anyone to hire any teacher or principal who may have taken a RIP, but it's just another part of the solution. I think you point out, we can ask the question, how many would be available, how many might be hired back. We don't really know that. I'm not really sure that we can really say with any certainty, how many teachers would be hired back under this system, but at least it's an option. And I think in that, it's a value to districts, and I'd appreciate us moving ahead and having a bill from this committee.
Further comments? Any objection? Yeah. Well, with that in mind, we will craft and hopefully have available next available earliest opportunity a committee bill that would address this thing. I would assume it would pass from the committee quite rapidly. The next item that I would like to discuss is HCR 11. Representative Guest, this is your day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was not here for the discussion.
And sorry to keep me on as the secretary and staff always does on the right side of the procedures. This is not up for a vote today. This is just a general discussion to bring it, refresh the committee, and then we can notice it and bring it up for a vote at a later date. Correct. Representative Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was not in the committee when this concept came up before. It's a concept of making education a standing committee, and I've heard from many people on this committee that they are interested in this bill moving forward. I am more than willing, as I've told you, Mr. Chairman, to have it become a committee bill. I have no pride of ownership, and I will do the work on the bill if the committee so sees. I just need some direction from the committee.
I understand the existing proposal would need to be adjusted a little bit. Is that correct?
Because it would. I guess the committees, and I would appreciate the opinion of those who have been around longer than I have. The bill as it stands is a joint resolution. It would ask the Senate at the same time, and there is a bill in the Senate, to form a standing committee as well. I think we have a few options if we want to go forward. We can go forward with this bill, see what the Senate does, maybe amend it later if we need to, if they're not going, if they don't want to go in the same direction. Or we can amend it now, kind of say we're not going to deal with the Senate, we'll do it in the House and they can do whatever they want. I have not really explored this with the Senate. I'm more than willing to do that and to see what their feelings are about the issue.
Committee comments on the option of as pursuing it as it is written or making it a resolution that would simply affect the House and allow the other body to move in their own wisdom. Representative Porter.
Well, I think if the House wanted to consider it for the House only, rules would not be necessary. The only thing we'd have to do is pass a resolution to establish a special committee.
Well, it'd actually be a standing committee then, would it? If you perpetuate us, I don't know. That's
and that is, I guess, the other
six of one and a half dozen yeah. another. In reality,
mm-hmm.
I think the most, well, perhaps the most interesting discussion of this will be when it hits the Hess committee.
Yeah,
and see if they want to take the E out of their committee. I really don't have a preference one way or another. I think it's a worthwhile discussion. If for no other reason, it should probably continue.
Representative Wilson, then guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having served on both committees, have their hands full. And I think it would be wonderful to be able to separate them out because there are so many issues in both areas that it's very difficult to get them all through one committee. So, and to do a good job of really really researching what needs to be done and really looking at each item and getting a full feeling of what's really going on. So I think it's very important. And most states separate them out.
That's certainly correct. I, as a former chair of Hess, got a lot of surprised looks when from other state legislators when they said, you do what? And Representative Porter and I know how full the Hess plate can be as well, and you meet three and four times a week. This is kind of a blessing to meet once a week. Representative Guest.
I was just going to echo what Representative Wilson said in response to Representative Porter's comment. Being new to this process, I'm still learning about special committees, but I'll use 211 as an example. I think we had a good policy debate on whether or not it was good education policy, and now we're going to go to another committee to have the same debate when I really believe the debate now is a fiscal policy issue. I'm worried if we make it a special committee on education, things will still go from education to Hess on, and I don't know if that's the best thing for this body versus making it a standing committee, which says we're going to have one group wake up every day and think about health and social services and another wake up every day and think about education.
Representative Stevens.
Actually, much has been said, Mr. Chairman, that I wanted to say, and I think just the fact that we have three freshman legislators on this, we probably don't have a perspective that you may have or the speaker may have, but I do appreciate the fact that that the speaker established this committee and as well as yourself as chair, just the fact that we have it, that we really were able to concentrate on the issues, so many important issues this year, last year, but I don't think that's going away. I think they'll continue to be extremely important issues because it's such a big part of our budget, so we'll always have this. I can see actually having serving on Hess with many of the others of you, it would have just bogged Hess down to have to deal with all of its issues as well as with education. So I certainly appreciate us moving ahead with a standing committee if that's possible.
Well, knowing
I'm not worrying about the Senate at this point,
knowing very well that the work magnifies to fill the committees available. With that, even with that caution in mind, I think the chair would appreciate Representative Guest if we could address this as a House issue only, and then bring it back before the committee and for committee action.
Would the chair like this to be a House committee bill, or would you like me to resubmit it? Because I think it now needs to go to a resolution versus a concurrent resolution.
Yeah, a resolution. Let's take care of get our house in order. No pun intended. And we'll lead by example. And if the other's body doesn't feel that this is fits well in their structure, they have that option and can do as they see fit. Representative Porter.
I guess fundamental to the discussion is a question that I can't answer, which so I'll pose it. I don't know if the House can establish a standing committee that would require a rule change without it somehow being addressed by the Senate one way or the other. So that might be something we'd want to run through Ledge Legal.
Yeah. And I think we've had some feedback on that we could indeed do that.
But I will double check.
But yeah, that would be essential. And from a, I suppose, practical politics point of view, it may give more push to this if it became a committee bill. And if you have, if that does not cause you angst, we could take it on as a committee bill. Representative Wilson.
I have a question, and I'm sure that this debate has happened before I was here, you know. But it's really kind of a catch-22 whether to put the early development in with the HESP or to put it in with education. And I wasn't here when that discussion took place. Do you guys have any input so that we would understand why it's in with education versus in with social services, with health and social services? In most states, I think that's separate, and it's in HESP, but that's something to think about.
Representative Porter.
I would say that is a title of a department that this particular administration has. It may not be the title of the department next year, so I don't think we should probably get that adventurous at this stage.
Okay. Yes, Representative McGinn.
At this point, I think the way the uniform rules are is they specify the departments, and right now, as the speaker said early, development is in the Department of Education. If that changes, then we'll change.
Okay. We will look forward to your report, Representative. That brings us to another possible committee bill, and that's a discussion on the possibility of a committee bill on student survey. The administration had come and asked that I bring this to the committee, or at least ask that I do something about it. So I chose, like all good legislators, to delegate, bring it to the committee. And Mr. Lindstrom, if you would join us, please, and share with the committee the rationale behind asking for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Elmer Lindstrom, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health and Social Services. We're interested, for a variety of reasons, of getting good health data through anonymous health surveys conducted in the schools. It's a long-standing practice to do such surveys. We have one particular survey that's kind of the gold standard of such surveys, the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, that I suspect most members have seen. But there certainly are other surveys that school districts may choose to do as well. Several years ago, a legislation was introduced and passed that changed the mechanism by which parents consent to having these surveys conducted, from a passive parental consent mechanism where a parent opts out if they choose, believe their child should not participate, to an active parental consent methodology where you have to opt in. And it is proven impossible, in fact, for school districts to achieve a level of participation that provides for valid data. There's been a lot of research on anonymous surveys nationwide. In fact, I think you probably have in your packet a literature review that looks at this subject. And I think most of the research concludes that typically parents don't object to these surveys being conducted, but in fact it is simply when you give, there's a lot of leakage between the point in time where a child is given a document in a school, getting home, being signed, and coming back to the school. And really, in most instances, parents do not object to these kind of surveys. And parents who might object would, in fact, opt out of a survey. So we would be very interested in going back to the passive parental consent mechanism. What's at stake as a practical matter for local districts is the ability to apply for a significant amount of funding from various sources where this data is useful in bolstering the needs for different types of funding. Likewise, the Department of Education and Early Development has a use in that vein, as does the public health infrastructure, as well as other state agencies. So it is truly very, very, very valuable information. And we would appreciate the ability to go back to a system that works, because this current system does not. I've had extensive conversations with the sponsor of the legislation of several years ago. We expressed our concern at the time that we believe that this would prove to be problematic, the act of parental consent. And he assured us at that time that if that proved to be the case, he would be willing to revisit that issue, and he is a man of his word, and has indicated that he understands how problematic it has been at this point to get that active parental consent. I feel a little bit awkward sitting here as a Department of Health and Social Services person. In fact, this is the first time I've been before the Special Education Committee, maybe getting back to the
Special
previous...
Special Committee on Education.
Special Committee on Education, getting back to the previous discussion.
No, and this from is, your history, I could understand how you confused the two.
And this is a bill that would actually touch the education statutes as opposed to ours, but it is one that is very important to both agencies. And we would very much appreciate your interest in that legislation.
Mr. Lindstrom, you know, we have a relationship going way back to Hess days, and so I have some confidence in what you have to say, but I feel an obligation to ask this question anyway.
Absolutely.
We're all aware of the famous memo from the current chief of staff of the governor that said, and I paraphrase, we're going to do what we can to make the governor look good and the legislative majority look bad. Do I have your assurance that this is not something to put the legislative majority in a box?
You have my absolute guarantee on that, Mr. Chairman, and I will be sitting here at this table speaking for the administration in support of this legislation every step of the way.
Thank you. Representative Guest.
Thank you, Elmer. Is this giving the option to be active or passive to a school district, or telling a school district they have to be passive, get passive consent unless they choose not to? Can you tell us what, for those of us who weren't here before, how that worked?
Mr. Chairman, I don't really know if you've actually had a bill addressed at this point.
We don't have the bill here, but I think the question was, how did it previously work before it was changed?
My recollection, Mr. Chairman, and certainly I believe our desire would be that districts be allowed to do passive parental consent if for some reason or another a district believed that they wanted to do active parental consent. I think that's an entirely legitimate a choice. I would be surprised if many chose to do that, although it is possible because it's extraordinarily expensive to get that active parental consent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess for the record, in case somebody hasn't been around for a few years to know what went on previously, the change in the requirement of a passive to an active permission of a parent for a survey was not if the student was being asked what they had for breakfast. It was pretty specific. But do you remember what the specific wording was?
Mr. Chairman, there are a variety of surveys, and most of the discussion centered again on the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and it speaks to issues of alcohol use, possible drug use, sexual activity and behaviors, and so forth. So certainly those concerns are very understandable. But a point I did not make that is really the essence of understanding this: these are anonymous surveys that are in no way ever attributable to an identifiable individual in the classroom. They are totally anonymous, so we do not have the ability to know who answered questions in any fashion, and a child would always have the ability to not answer any given question or simply not take the questionnaire upon seeing the questionnaire.
Representative Porter.
Just one follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The loss of federal funds because of this requirement, are you saying that because our law requires an active permission, that automatically precludes federal participation, or their surveys have not been complete enough or something?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, when you are unable to get a valid representative sample, the survey becomes useless for the purpose of suggesting to a possible granting agency, this is what the data says, because the data is simply not valid if you don't have a representative sample of the population.
I think it was a numbers problem. They didn't get enough return. Representative Stevens?
Well, is this on this point that you needed the speaker?
Oh, okay.
Remember why we have an education system and who it's for, and of course, it seems like we're sort of flying blind if we don't know what's happening to students. So we need to know if there's a major change in student behavior, a major change in high-risk sexual activity and use of drugs. It just seems like, and as long as it's anonymous, it seems like it's necessary that we have these facts so we can help students, which is why we are spending so much of our money and our energy and our time in education. So I think it's a very appropriate thing for us to make this change.
Chair, an old legislative trick. Now you add, don't you agree, so there will be a question in there.
Don't you agree, Mr. Chairman?
Could I ask that we limit our comments this time to questions? We have someone else to testify, and then we can open it to committee discussion. Yes.
And my apologies, because I'm going to ask for your leniency. I have caucus, and so I need to go.
I need to talk to the minority leader about his lack of respect for this committee.
Please do. I would just like to say I don't think I think we should do this. I think not only is it important to have the data, it's important for local control. We as a state should not be telling a school district that they have to do this one way or the other. They should have the option, and they should have the trade-offs of that.
And apply for probably other topics as well.
Yes.
Just real quickly, in this case,
you're all gone also.
Mr. Chairman, the absence of our minority leader, I need to be
talking. He is the evil.
You're the problem.
Okay, I have your proxy while you're gone. That'll be fine.
No, sir.
All right. Larry, I think we... If just you'd stay with us for further questions. But Larry Wiggett in Anchorage. Larry, you have comments on this potential bill?